amphetamine was rampant at the time. And it was not uncommon at all for me to pull a car over and find a trunk load of ether, you know, mason jars full of ether. They sold these mini thins, the ephedrine tabs at truck stops. And I could pull over a car and find an active meth lab with a hydrogen generator, ether, and pseudoephedrine all contained in one car. And it wasn't hard to do at all. As soon as I started to recognize that, it became fun for me. You know what I mean? I loved, no disrespect to them, but I loved chasing tweakers. The meth heads were, they're the most fun. Wild. You know, they were always out stealing anhydrous or stealing stuff from cars or breaking in places and cooking dope and trading dope.
Hey guys, welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murphy in the Morning. I'm your host, Steve Murphy. Thank you folks for coming to join us again every week. I know it's not because of me, and I'm serious when I say that. I know it's because of the great guests I bring on here. This week is no different. Just quickly, if you haven't checked us out on YouTube yet, do me a favor. Go over there, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar at the top. When you pull it up, take a look at some of the episodes, hit that subscribe button, maybe hit the like button, and send me some comments if you'd like to. Help a brother out here. So as I mentioned, today's guest is someone I met a couple of years ago. I should have had him on the show right away. I had his partner on the show. And for whatever reason, I guess it's just the old age thing, the old timers kicking in. Some people say Alzheimer's. I hope it's not it. But I finally got him on the show. And as soon as I asked him, he didn't hesitate to say yes. So ladies and gentlemen, it's my honor to introduce you to Dutch McAlpin, 20 plus years in law enforcement. Dutch, brother, welcome so much to the Game of Crimes.
Thank you, Steve, man. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be on the show with you. You're a legend. Your story speaks for itself. So I'm honored to be here and thank you so much for your time.
Well, and that's why people bring people on here, because these guys are good for my ego. It's my wife. You guys have been listening to the show for a while. You know, my wife keeps me very much grounded. She's like, hey, Hollywood, take the trash out. Cut the grass while you're out there. But this week we're going to have our opening, the small town police blotter. Sometimes I cut it out depending on who the guest is. But as usual, I didn't tell Dutch about this until about 15 minutes before we started recording, and he didn't hesitate. So, Dutch, let me just read a quick disclaimer here so we don't get sued. The lawyers tell me I got to do this, or my previous co-host, Morgan Wright, told me I got to do this. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we take our stories here on the show very, very seriously, but we never want to miss an opportunity to have a chuckle at some of these stupid criminals that are out there, because you just never run out of stories. So Dutch is out in Missouri, and we found one from him to read from out there. That's I love your story, man. I was looking for another one. I thought, nope, that's the one. So if you would, go ahead and read that for us, brother.
Liquor store clerk draws faster. A would-be armed robber was in for a big surprise when he decided to steal from a liquor store in Marionville, Missouri. I'm not sure where that's at, but small towns, you know. I come from a small town. I know what that's like. War veteran and former prison guard John Lewis Alexander was working the cash register that day when the suspect entered the shop while smoking a cigarette. After reportedly telling him to put it out, Alexander has a gun pulled on him. So I guess a bad guy pulls a gun on this store clerk.
Right.
Without even missing a beat, the ex-military man hits the weapon back, draws out his own handgun, and points it directly in the criminal's face.
I love it.
Needless to say, the robber quickly accepts and backs out of the store. I wish there was more detail. I wish we could have a picture of like what this exactly looks like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're not kidding. And that's, you know, him backing out of that store is the best decision he made that day.
I wouldn't rob a store in a small town of Missouri. It's a constitutional state. You should be not surprised at all when someone pulls a gun on you if you try to rob them here. I mean, not smart move on his part.
Yeah. There's some people that chose a career of crime and they obviously made the wrong career choice.
There can't be much money in robbing a liquor store in Marionville either, I'm sure.
Oh, it's amazing what they do. It's just amazing. So Everybody knows I'm here in Orlando, Florida. I've got another story up here for you from, you know, starts out Florida man. And it comes from St. Pete, which Dutch, just for your clarification here, man, it seems like most of the crazy crime stories we get out of Florida are over in St. Pete, Tampa area. I don't know what it is about that because it's beautiful over there, but just there's some real wackadoos. So anyway, a door distributor in St. Pete, Florida appears to have made the right call when they denied a job interview to a man with an extensive criminal history, as far as not being cut out for the job is concerned anyway. The folks at Doors Molding and More had no idea that 51-year-old John Connaughton was going to respond to the interview denial by filling up multiple bottles with pee. That's right, pee, and then throwing the bottles into their business. Although there's an argument to be made that they should have seen that response coming. Who hasn't had a full bottle with pee thrown at them, a plan like that ready to go, and they ask for and not receive a job interview? Anyway, this oversight resulted in urine being splashed on merchandise inside the business as well as on the bare legs of one of the employees. The estimated value of the merchandise that came into contact with the urine is $1,000. There's no dollar amount listed for the trauma to the employee inflicted by allegedly having a lunatic's pee come in contact with their bare legs. One would hope they were at least given the rest of the day off with pay, but, you know, I doubt that happened, to be honest with you. The Pinellas County affidavit says Connaughton was charged with felony battery and criminal mischief for his urine-soaked meltdown. He added an aggravated assault charge as he fled on foot because he's stupid. He's accused of threatening to hit someone with a skateboard by raising it over his head as if to strike them with it after they chased him while he was fleeing. He probably wanted to let the guy tossing the urine go and let the authorities deal with that part. And then News Channel 8 over there adds that according to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Connaughton is also a registered sex offender. You prick.
Yeah.
And I agree with Channel 8 when they said I would, and I could be wrong here, but I don't think any of this is going to help that guy land a job. Do you?
You're telling me a 50-year-old man with a skateboard and a bottle of piss.
Yeah.
That's the end of the story.
What I was expecting to read in his criminal history was charged with possession of meth.
Yeah, for sure.
We have a rule here on the Game of Crime, and that's kids don't do meth. That's our number one rule. So
good rule.
Brother, thank you for playing along here. I know it's silly, but it kind of gets things off because some of the topics we cover here, they do get a little dark sometimes.
Yeah, they do.
That's probably going to happen again today because you had such a crazy career.
Yeah.
And just to let everybody know how we met, there's another retired police officer out of Jersey that was a guest on the show. His name is Giovanni Rocco. He was episode 161. This was back in September of 2024. So over a year ago. And Rocco and Dutch here are co-host of a podcast called Inside the Life Podcast, and it's connected directly with the Mob Museum out in Las Vegas. Now, I mean, talk about a sweet gig. I'm just curious, how'd you guys land that?
Excuse me, Steve. Well, Giovanni Rocco had an amazing career, and he's done some wild things, as you well know. And you, me, him, all of us that lived in this kind of covert lifestyle, I think at some point, you know, when you live covert and you don't talk about the things that you've done, you've been through, you keep them inside, and finally enough time's gone by that you feel comfortable talking about it, it's kind of therapeutic to get it out, you know, get it off your chest and talk about it. And it's also a good feeling when the rest of the world validates that the things you've seen and done were wild and crazy and interesting. So Giovanni Rocco wrote a book called Giovanni's Ring.
Right.
And I think he did a book release at the Mob Museum, and they basically got to talking to him about doing a podcast and hosting the show. And he invited me to do it with him. And we did a couple trial runs, and it turned out to be pretty successful. And Giovanni and I are so, so much different. I'm from a small town in Iowa, and he's from, larger city in New Jersey. And, you know, he walks, talks East Coast like no other. I mean, you hear his voice, you can tell where he's from.
Oh, yeah.
But our contrast works well. You know, I have a different perspective of things that we've seen. And I think you can put three people in a room and set them up with some crazy scenario that happens, and then you bring them out of the room, they'll all tell you the same story, but the perspective is a little different, right? I mean, it's the same true story, but he saw something I didn't see, or I saw something he didn't see, or he recognized something in a voice inflection or some body language that I didn't notice. And the two of us, although we're very different and we contrast each other in ways, we also really help boost each other's credibility, I think. And so absolutely. I think the Mob Museum saw that and noticed that. And it's been a good relationship for the Mob Museum in Las Vegas, and for Giovanni and I both, all three of us have had a good experience with that show. And having you on there was definitely a highlight. You know, I remember you coming on there and telling stories, and I think we brought some stuff out of you hadn't talked about in a long time. And that was a good experience for all of us.
Yeah, just so you know, I'm still having problems with those stories.
No, I'm not. Sad, you're sad.
That was fun, and I think that came out during season two, mm-hmm. which was actually I looked it up. It was May of 25 when it was released, and again, everybody, that's the Inside the Life podcast. But you guys had Javier on there during the first season, right?
Yes, we did. Yep.
Yes, I was looking through some of the episodes. Man, you've had some studs on there.
Yeah, we've had some great guests. All fascinating people, interesting people for sure.
And the cool thing is, everybody, they bring you out to the Mob Museum. You actually go down to the basement there, and they got a nice little studio set up, and they got coffee and donuts.
Uh-huh. Yes. They treat you good.
Stereotypical donuts. That's right. I'm good with that. That was just a really nice trip. And then you guys were gracious enough to give me a ride back to the airport so I could come home. And yeah, we got to do a lot of visiting in that ride.
Yeah,
I think Rocco was driving. We might have got lost a couple times. Were you driving? Maybe you
drive. No, he was driving. I don't drive.
So, but it's a good trip. But that's how you meet people. And, and you know, a lot of people hear me talk about the law enforcement brotherhood and sisterhood. And it's absolutely true. You know, met these guys. I mean, other than that one time, that's the only time Dutch and I have ever hung out together. Mm-hmm. But I feel like he can call me and ask me for anything, and he's got it, and vice versa.
Absolutely. 100%.
It's just the way it is. And that's what you – I worried about missing that in retirement. I don't know about you, Dutch, but this podcast gives me the opportunity to kind of live vicariously through what other law enforcement guys – you know, because a lot of guys are still active or military mm-hmm. that come on here. But just hearing the stories, you know, my wife says, when are you going to retire? Or if you ask her when I'm going to retire, she'll say when he dies. I don't know if she's got a plan or what. She might have a plan here. I might pursue that just a little bit, find out what's going on in the background.
I think, you know, you talked about Javier and you working together, and Giovanni and I working together, and our conversations in the car. And I think if any valuable thing I learned in that career was that you need to network when you have the opportunity, right? You recognize people with certain skill sets maybe you don't have, or assets or things that they can teach you or show you or lesson you about. So, you know, you and I both going through pretty high stake careers, I think we learned to network and appreciate those moments. So I definitely agree. You can call me anytime. I'm there 100%, whatever you need.
Absolutely, man. And that's, you know, just speaking about that, when one of the things you learn, well, that's what you do. You learn from other people through their activities and how they handle certain situations. And even back when I was on the job in a supervisory capacity, you know, some of our guys have extremely large egos and personalities.
Yep.
And they think they know everything. And I would tell them, when you've come to the day that you don't learn something new, I want your transfer papers or your retirement papers. I don't want you working in here anymore, because you're going to get yourself or one of the other guys hurt here, and it's just not worth it. So, man, maybe just because I'm a lot less intelligent than they are. Maybe they do know everything, and I'm just lost out in left field. I don't know. I'm pretty happy out in left field, so that's it. There you go. So, Dutch, if you would, tell us about where you grew up, what your family dynamics were, if you had brothers and sisters, what mom and dad did, playing sports in high school, things like that.
Yeah, no problem. Excuse me, man. I got a cough here. I grew up in a small town in Iowa. The name of the town's Clarinda. It's back at the time, I'd say it was less than 7,000 people, mostly rural. The only thing in that town of substantial employment was a prison and a couple of factories. It wasn't not to say it wasn't an interesting and wonderful community, but it wasn't very diverse. It's mostly all white, middle class, a lot of farm people, a lot of blue collar workers. My dad worked at a factory where they made semi-truck transmissions. My mom worked at a different factory, and they both, you know, started out working midnights and then went on to days. And people from that community don't call in sick to work, and they don't take vacation. I mean, they work all the time. It's part of their principal values. And I appreciate that. You know, they taught me to be a hard worker, and they taught me a lot of good values. Definitely, I didn't grow up around gangs and hard people and hard lives necessarily. I knew of them. I knew they were around us. But in a small community where everybody knows everybody, I think the way you treat people comes back to you. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're just nice to people and you just try to be open-minded and accepting of everybody in certain situations is living a different lifestyle than you, but that doesn't mean that you have to disrespect them or anything like that. I think it goes a long way.
Right.
And it will. I mean, I'll probably get into a story where I think living life, being kind and trying to treat people with respect and learn things from them comes back to save you. I know on a job a couple of times, citizens hopped in and helped me out when I probably was about to get my ass kicked or worse. And thank God I had been friendly to them on a different call or treated that neighborhood fairly at least. And they helped me out and probably saved my butt more than once. Right. But I had a brother and a sister. My brother's also a cop. He's been a cop for years. I didn't grow up. I never met a cop in my life. I never knew a cop. I never knew a cop by name. I think I probably got a speeding ticket or two, maybe. But nothing too. I was a little ornery, but I didn't get into trouble per se, you know. Probably caught me a few too many bush lights in my pickup after football practice a few times or something, but nothing too serious. Yeah, right. And I definitely did some ornery stuff. And I did, you know, growing up, there was drugs around. There was methamphetamine. There was marijuana. There was, you know, probably all the drugs that every city has access to. And they were in the community, but you kind of had to search for them and look for them if you wanted them. And everybody kind of knew where to get them. That wasn't my thing. I played football. I wrestled. I boxed. I boxed in high school. I fought in the Golden Gloves. And when I say I fought in the Golden Gloves, I didn't win in Golden Gloves. I got knocked down, man. I got beat up bad. That wasn't a successful thing other than good training and good education, but I wasn't good at it. But I did box, wrestle, and play football. My brother is 13 months apart from me. He's my younger brother. And then I have a sister who's younger than us by that. But we grew up in a good community. My parents were together most of our life. They eventually got divorced late into our high school years. And that's just part of life. That's what happens. But I still had a good upbringing and a good, stable family, you know, surrounding. I had my dad in my life. I had my mom in my life. I think one of the kind of significant things that happened to me is I didn't know any cops. I didn't want to be a cop. I hadn't crossed my mind yet. But at some point, my dad had lost his job. A bunch of people gotten laid off. And we moved to a town outside of Detroit, Michigan called Ypsilanti. And we moved from a small town in Iowa to Ypsilanti. And nobody had any money. Everybody got laid off at the same time. So we lived in an apartment complex called Camelot Apartments. And my brother and I had a bedroom that we shared with two guys that worked with my dad. So we had bunk beds on one side of the wall. And then these other two guys, Stanley and Garvin, had bunk beds in our same room on the other side of the wall. And my aunt slept on the couch and my sister slept on the floor. And all of us lived in this little, it was actually a little two bedroom apartment. And all the men of the house worked at the college. They worked for a place called Cable Pullers. And they were basically putting in, back when we still had phone lines, they were putting in phones at the college campus. And all of a sudden I was living in a community that was much more diverse, much bigger, and had a lot of different elements going on that I hadn't seen before. To kind of paint a picture, all the apartments were brick. There was a chain link fence with barbed wire around the top on most of the campus, and Kmart was in the parking lot next door. And I remember one night, me and Stanley and Garvin which is such a weird thing to have two grown men sleeping in your bedroom, but yeah. What the times call for, you do. You know what I mean? It was a safe place. There wasn't any trouble with that. It was just necessity. But I remember we heard a bunch of gunshots, and we saw the police come chasing a guy through in those apartment buildings. You know, you have like a common area where there's grass and kids can play and ride bikes and fly kites and do whatever they do. And they were chasing these guys through this campus, and they were shooting back and forth. And I think the next day we read or saw like the Kmart next door had a place where they would cash checks. And these guys had come to cash their checks, and the robbery happened, and the police showed up, and they, I guess, seemed like they got into a shootout or whatever has happened out there. But I would see the police roll into this community where I live. My brother and I were the only two white males in the campus, and we went to a school where everybody, I think we were the only two white males in our school, counting teachers. And not a bad experience, just a very different experience than coming from a small town in Iowa. But the only time I'd seen police officers in a small town in Iowa was, you know, they'd pull you over speeding or I don't know, whatever they did. We just didn't have any contact with them. But in this community, when the police would show up, the chaos would stop, right? And I thought these guys looked cool, man. They had pressed uniforms on. They had cruisers. They're carrying a gun and a badge. And people are listening and doing what they're said. And I do remember that standing out in my mind. It's like, that's pretty cool. But we ended up moving back to Iowa. Once the economy stabilized, you know, we moved back there and my parents got their jobs back in their factories and life got better again. And we lived the rest of my high school life in Iowa. I was playing football my junior year of high school and the Iowa National Guard showed up to hand out watermelon and Gatorade at football practice. I didn't know what the Iowa National Guard was either, but I had kind of fantasized about joining the Army and going to do cool Army stuff. And these guys were like, well, you can join the Army right now. And I didn't know what they meant by that, but I couldn't sign up fast enough. I was like, I can join it right now. What's that mean? They said, well, we have what's called a split op. They called it split op. I don't know what that means other than between my junior year and senior year of high school, I flew to Fort Benning, Georgia and went through Army basic training. And then I came back, did my senior year of high school, but I still had to go train with the National Guard while I was in high school. Now the good thing about that is I said I grew up with a good family and a good life, and I did, but I ran around with some rowdy friends, and those friends know who they are. And I probably could have gotten myself into trouble, but since I had joined the military, I was being drug tested. You know, I'd never been drug tested in my life. So I had someone holding me accountable other than my teenage self. And so one, I missed the whole summer between junior and senior year where normally probably went out drinking beer and partying and who knows what with my rowdy friends. Instead, I flew to Fort Benning and I got a lesson in discipline. I got a lesson in, you know, working together as a team and being a part of something, which was a good solid skill to get as a very young kid like that. I do my high school senior year. And I go back to Fort Benning, Georgia. I do my advanced infantry training. I was 11 Bravo as an infantry. And I finished that up and I come back home. And I think I had thought that if I did boot camp and AIT before I got out of high school, then when I graduated, they would let me sign up, just transfer me right to full-time Army. And I would do that. Well, that's not how it works. The Iowa National Guard wants their money back for the money they spent getting you trained, and they're going to keep you around for a while before they cut you loose to do something else.
Yeah.
Which worked out in my benefit considering the way my life went. I don't really know what I was going to do for a job. I had enrolled in college I had a GI Bill right away. So I enrolled in a community college here in Clarinda, and that was not for me. I mean, we'd be sitting in class. I was doing night class, and me and my buddy Riley would be sitting there figuring out ways to get out of class and go hunting and drink beer and hang out and do fun stuff together instead of paying attention. So college wasn't my thing. And my aunt said, well, why don't you work in this jail? And I had no interest in working in the jail, but it paid well. And it was an opportunity. You know, I'm 18, barely 18. I'm just fresh out of high school. And they get me a job working part-time in this jail while I'm part-time going to college at best. And that's where I really was like, oh, there's cops bringing people into jail. You know, we had the city police departments bringing people in, and then we had the county sheriff's office bringing people in, and the county sheriff's office ran and maintained the jail, as are in most states, I believe. Right. And while I was there, I don't know if you want to keep going down this path or if you want to interrupt me and ask some questions, but.
Yeah. Let me back up just a second. When you were, when you first joined the guard and you went, did your training, were you getting paid?
Yes.
So yes. I'm guessing you were what, 17 years old?
Yeah, I was. Yep. I was 17. And I think it was 3 days after my junior year, I was on an airplane. I'd never been on an airplane in my life. Three days after I got out of junior year, I was on an airplane down to Fort Benning, Georgia. I remember I flew to Atlanta and I got on a bus and took the bus down to Fort Benning. And then I went into like a holdover period, and man, my life got changed real quick, real fast.
Oh yeah.
Once boot camp started.
And the climate down there in the summertime is just so pleasant, isn't it?
Fort Benning? It's real nice. Yeah. They got fire ants and snakes and dirt, and it's hot, hot all the time. Hot.
And there's a reason they call it Hot Atlanta.
Yeah. And they move you around in cattle cars. I mean, back then, the Army's idea of moving troops quickly about the base was in these steel semi-truck trailers that looked like livestock trailers. They called them cattle cars. And, yeah, man, life got changed quick. But I'll tell you this, Steve. I was running miles and miles every day in PT. I was eating a perfect diet. I'm not saying it tasted good, but it was good for your body.
Right.
And I came back my senior year for football, a whole different kind of football player too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I bet it impressed the coaches.
I don't know if impressed anybody, but it sure seemed a lot easier to me.
Yeah. So you're in the guard, when you went to the sheriff's office, and we're talking about Montgomery County, Iowa, right?
Yes.
Did they send you to any kind of academy to learn how to be a corrections officer?
Right. Nope. So, you know what? Excuse me. Yes, I believe they did. I don't remember much about that. It was something very basic. I think back then, staff in the jail were not law enforcement officers. They were not certified. They were actually called jailers. And they would send you to the Iowa Police Academy, and they'd give you like a basic jail certification course. So, yeah, I had to do that. I had to wear a brown uniform and a star badge and everything but a gun, and I had no authority other than inside the jail, which is best because I was 18. You know, I didn't have any business really having any other authority and barely running that jail at best. So they did send me to, like, I think it was like a week-long basic jail school or something like that.
Okay. And so here you are, 18 years old. You've never really been around, I guess, criminals per se,
right?
Other than what you saw on Ypsilanti.
Yep.
What were you thinking? Were you thinking, what the hell am I doing here?
Not really. I mean, it didn't bother me. I was fascinated. You know what I mean? Like, I had these, it was all men. It was all men in the jail at the time. I think if there was a female that was brought in, they transferred her to some other jail. But at the time, I think we were holding inmates for federals, for the feds, for the Marshal Service. And we were also holding inmates for Polk County, Iowa, which is Des Moines, which is the largest city in Iowa, which isn't very big, probably 500,000 or less. But they were real criminals. And we had people in there for every crime you can imagine. That they hadn't necessarily happened in Montgomery County, but the sheriff there had figured out how to like charge these other counties an amount of money. So I was getting exposed to, I'd say some really hard criminals. So a lot of them had been in prison multiple times. There was definitely some prison gang affiliation within the prison or within the jail. And we had inmates that were definitely dangerous.
Did you ever receive any threats from being in there?
No, I got along good. I learned a lot of times I was by myself in that jail. We had a bullpen set up. So during the daytime, the inmates were free to roam around within the bullpen. And at night, they were pushed inside the bullpen and locked in their cells. But that had to be manly done. So I'd have to walk into the cell with, 13, 14 male inmates that had been in jail several times and basically convince them to get in their cells and let me lock them down. And they did, because I learned how to be respectful, be fair. You know, if I give you coffee, I give everybody coffee. If right. I have a rule, then everybody has to follow the rule. And that served me well, because even though as a kid, I think the men took it easy on me. They're like, this is just a kid, you know, but being fair and being direct with them, definitely, I think they respected that and it helped me. But I do remember a guy I worked with named Zach one night. This guy was in a jail holding on a sexual assault charge on a child. And they had a little machine in there where he could lift weights. And, you know, one of the old cable machines. And Zach was doing his jail check in the middle of the night. And I don't know if they weren't locked down or what, but this guy had taken that cable and figured out a way to saw through the cable and had it in his hands. And he choked this kid unconscious. Zach was 18, 19 years old too. And he choked this jailer unconscious in the middle of the night and escaped from the jail. And we ended up recovering him down in Mexico months and months later. But I guess I just don't want to take away from people that work in corrections. You know, it's not a fun job. It's not fun at all, but it can also be dangerous. And, managing that kind of population is its own kind of job. And in there, I definitely learned how to speak criminal, if you will, how to speak street, how to like talk to these different kinds of people.
Right. Yeah. Javi and I speak to a lot of, we do a lot of NARC conferences around the country, but we also speak at a lot of gang conferences. And I'm actually on the board of directors for the Southern California Gang Conference out in San Diego. And you look at these guys and I'm just thinking, why did you choose to be a corrections officer? But especially in California, well, and I guess most of the states now with all the gangs that are in the prison, especially the Mexican mafia and all the offshoots of that. And then you got the white supremacists and the black gangs and the other Hispanic gangs. When you sit down and talk to these guys, they know their stuff. I mean, it's impressive to talk to them. They know relationships between each other, who's responsible, who the shot callers are, the language that's used, the things to look out for. Mm-hmm. They know how to cultivate snitches within the prisons, which I can't imagine doing that. But I've just – before, the only thing I ever knew about jailers was what I saw, just like you, in our local county jail there in southern West Virginia. And I'm thinking, man, I did a summer internship and spent 5 weeks at the county jail. And I thought, this is the last thing I ever wanted to do.
Oh, yeah.
It was horrible. It stunk. You know, just people were all nasty in there.
Yeah.
But it's, I guess when you get on the, I hate to say a more professional level, but on a larger level, you know, I guess those guys have honed their professionalism to, a fine art. It's very impressive.
It is. They have their own career and I couldn't do it. I'm not capable of that. But while I was in the jail, I took time to talk to these guys and they're happy to share information with you. You know what I mean? If you're respectful and you're genuine, I remember there was these guys in there that were, one of them had a tattoo on the back of his head of two hammers, like hitting each other. And they were Confederate hammer skinheads. I'd never seen a skinhead, never been one around my life. And I was like, what's this about? And they would tell me, or there was somebody from a black gang. I'm like, what's the BGs and what's this? And they would be happy to share the information from you. And if you're smart and you think that's a career you're going to be in, you'll take the time to extract that information from them and file it away in case you need it sometime,
Yeah. You can never know too much, man. Information's power. Like they say, that's absolutely true. How long did you work in there with the jailers?
Gosh, man, I don't remember, Steve. I can tell you this. I believe – so while I was working in a jail, I had seen the deputies coming in and the police officers, and I thought, those guys are pretty cool. Like, that looks kind of fun. And at the time – in small towns, they use this thing called reserve police officers. And the chief of the town in Red Oak there had said, well, you should be a reserve police officer with stuff. And I'm like, what's that? And they send you through some – basically on the job training, but before you know it, they'll give you a uniform and a gun and you're riding shotgun with one of the police officers and kind of learning about police stuff. And he had asked me to do that. And I kind of started down that path. I mean, I went and took some of the training and I started doing some ride alongs and I really started to get fascinated with it. But at some point I took the selection test, there's a written test and there used to be a physical agility test. And if you pass those tests, you'd be put on what's called an eligibility list. And the sheriff of the county that I worked in could hold that eligibility list for a certain amount of time. And he could choose to hire from that list whenever he wanted. Well, I worked hard and I didn't get into trouble, and I was professional, and I was learning. And for some reason, one of the deputies there had been charged with a very, very serious child abuse, felony child abuse. I think he had twin babies, and he had broken the arm of one of the kids and broken a leg. Yeah, it was bad. It was really, really bad. And it's a bad image for law enforcement, a bad image for the community. And it was bad for me because I looked up to the guy. I thought he was a good guy. I had no idea he was capable of that. And the sheriff's office kind of was going through a really hard time. They were losing personnel. A couple guys left and went to the state patrol. And because I had been there and he'd already gotten to know me, and I think he was tired of having people come in and work and step stone and move on or turn out to not be a good professional officer, he decided to give me a chance. And he called the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy and said, I got this kid I want to send to the academy, but he's not 21. And they did some – you went through this. I remember you told me this on our podcast, Inside of Life. I believe I was 19, and they said, the sheriff's office can own the gun and they can buy the ammunition, and the kid can carry it on duty. Yeah. And so they sent me to the police academy. I mean, within a week or two, I was at the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy going through my first police academy.
Wow. And how long was that academy?
I don't remember, man. I think
probably 3 months. So
no, yeah, I think maybe like 3.5-4 months, something like that. Started in March, ended in June. I think I got out June, mid first week of June in 96 is when I got there. So yeah, I'd have been like 19.
Yeah, it sounds so familiar.
Yeah, and the academies back then, I think they're a little different now. Some of them are the post academies. A lot of them are letting them go home at night. Ours was pretty militarized. It was actually on a National Guard camp, and we had to run in formation. We had to stay in our barracks every night. Mm-hmm. We were allowed to go home at the end of our training on Friday, but we had to be back there by Sunday night. We had room inspections and uniform inspections, and we studied Fourth Amendment along with, you know, all the fun police stuff. There's a lot of really critical learning points that have to do with constitutional law, because that's what our job's about.
Right. Right. It's you remember any really funny stories or anything you want to share with us from those academy days? Maybe some stupid pranks or.
Well, they had a lot of fun with me because most of these guys were grown men, you know, going through the academy, and they called me junior. Like, hey, junior, they're teasing me all the time. So, I mean, it's so long ago, Steve, I can remember some of the stuff we were doing, but we didn't jack around too much. They were pretty hard on us. You'd get smoked. You'd get, you know, you could get kicked out real easily. So I know we lost a couple of recruits that couldn't come back in their time that they were supposed to, or they got caught messing around with each other or something. And it was a pretty disciplined place. There wasn't a whole lot of fun. Law enforcement for me was very fun, but not at that moment. It was more like boot camp again.
Yeah. My first academy was the West Virginia State Police Academy for basic law enforcement, because I was a city police officer, and it brought a whole new level of discipline that I wasn't used to. Mm-hmm. And it was the same way. We had to live there. I don't think I've ever told this story. So we get to come home on weekends, and whatever girl I was dating at the time, I had a little too much to drink, and, you know, she's driving me home one night, and I'm snockered, and this, she had a Boss Mustang. I mean, that thing had the 4-speed her shifter for it. Uh-huh. And this kind of Volkswagen passes us, like, pull up next to him. And she pulls up next to him. Of course, we have words, and we end up out in the street fighting in the middle of the street. And when he came at me, he clawed the face. And I had blood, just, you know how your face bleeds when you're shaving. Yeah. Well, he's got like 6 good claw marks on my face, just down my face. And so we're down on the ground wrestling around. And she said, you want me to go get the police? And I said, yeah, go get them. And within just a couple of minutes, I hear this massive motor screaming down the street. And it's West Virginia State police officer that I knew, a guy named Randy Howe. And he's got a deputy sheriff in there with him that I knew him also. And his name escapes me right now. I can see his face. But they got out and saw that blood on me, and they're like, oh, my God, Murph's getting killed here.
Yeah.
And so they got him under control. But I had to go back to the academy like that. That was a Saturday night, and I had to go back on Sunday night. And I come walking in, and they're all like, oh, my God, would you be in a car wreck? We're going to have to – did a banshee attack you? And it was – other people, you know, people think they call it wild, wonderful West Virginia. Well, the people in other parts of West Virginia think Southern West Virginia is just like out there.
Yeah.
Like it's like a no man's land and people are crazy down there. And they're the nicest people in the world. But, you know, come back in looking like that. It's like, yeah, I had a little tussle over the weekend. Everything's good. Stupid things. Yeah. That's 19 years old. That's what 19 years old does.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure I had any business being in law enforcement at 19. It seemed like a good idea at the time, you know what I mean? But yeah. I don't think I was ready for that.
Were you still in the Guard during this time also?
Yeah. I stayed in the Guard for 6 years. I had a 6-2 split, so I had to do 6 years in the Guard. So I did throughout my early career there, I was still in the National Guard, and we just would train. I was over in Germany for a while. I got to travel around a little bit with them, and I met some awesome, wonderful people. I met some, interesting enough, my platoon leader of my National Guard unit, when I went to work at the police department there, which was bigger than I was used to, he worked there as well. And so a couple of guys I'd known for the National Guard ended up being police officers at some point in my career with me too. So I guess it was kind of like a feeder club to law enforcement, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover there. Mm-hmm. How long did you stay with the sheriff's office as a deputy now until you moved on to the city?
Oh, man, I think, let's see, 96. About 6 years, maybe 7 years at the most. I think I was there six years and then I moved.
Was there an event that you thought I'd rather work for the city than the county?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there was quite a few events, you know. I remember when I got out of the academy, then Montgomery County didn't even have an FDO program. I didn't even know what that was. You know, they basically got out of the academy, you're certified, you got a gun and a badge.
Go protect the world.
Go do some stuff, you know. And I had a sergeant that had to do a ride along. I think I rode with him for like 2 weeks, you know, and he basically was basically just telling me the layout of the county, you know, like, don't get lost out here. You're by yourself. There's your backups minimum 20 minutes away if there's even anybody awake to back you up. And I remember we pulled a car over. It was in the evening and the street light lit her up. And this lady had a little kid standing on the front dashboard. So he wanted me to write her a ticket. And it's all fun and dandy when you're in the academy and you're pretend copping. But I walked up to this lady car and I'm all of a sudden at a loss for words. Like, I'm the boss. I'm 19 or 20. I'm the authority here. You know what I mean? And I end up writing her a ticket and I go back and I hand her the ticket book and she signs it. And I'm like, all right, now you have a good night. And I go back to the car and a sergeant, his name is Butch. The sergeant's in the car. He's like, you give her a ticket? I'm like, yeah. He's like, where's your ticket book? I just gave her the whole ticket book and she drove off with it.
Souvenir.
I had to go pull her over and get my ticket book back again. She wasn't very happy about that. Yeah, real embarrassing, but it's humbling too. You know what I mean? Like, holy crap. I can tell you, I went through. So with that, I started to kind of get, there was not a lot of calls for service in small towns. If you think big cities don't call the police on each other, small towns don't call the police on each other. They're very neighborly. They're very aware of their neighborhoods, and they kind of let each other handle their own business. If you get called, a 911 call comes in for a call to service in these smaller communities, at least in my experience, some bad was happening. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time patrolling, like literally working. Amphetamine was rampant at the time, and it was not uncommon at all for me to pull a car over and find a trunk load of ether, you know, mason jars full of ether. They sold these mini thins, the ephedrine tabs at truck stops. And, I could pull over a car and find an active meth lab with a hydrogen generator, ether and pseudoephedrine all and contained in one car. And it wasn't hard to do at all. They were everywhere. And as soon as I started to recognize that, it became fun for me. You know what I mean? I loved, no disrespect to them, but I loved chasing tweakers. The meth heads were, they're the most fun. They're wild. You know, they were always out stealing anhydrous or stealing stuff from cars or breaking in places and cooking dope and trading dope. And I'd pulled over. Remember earlier I was talking about if you grow up in a community, you're nice to people, it comes back to you.
Right.
So I'm going down the highway. It's Highway 34. It's like 2:30 in the morning. I see this black Monte Carlo coming up the road. And it's like a 70s, 80s Monte Carlo, the old long boxy ones. The windows are blacked out. The whole car is black. And he looks like a bad guy, right? Because I'm not saying we profile, but you kind of do, right? You kind of profile a vehicle and an image and a time of day and a time of night. If you're smart, it's a good way to do work. So I just turn around to follow this guy. He turns his blinker on to turn left. And if you turn left, you can go back into town where the lights are and where people are. Or you can turn right and it goes down a gravel road where it's dark and a couple of hills into the gravel road. No one can see you or hear you. So his blinker's on to turn left and he turns right down the gravel road. I'm like, I'm so excited. I have probable cause to stop this car. I turn my lights on, my overheads on, you know, I'm ready to go. I'm in a position of authority. And he rolls a couple of hills and he gets to the bottom of the next hill and he stops, puts the car in park. You know, you see the brake lights come on, it's running. And I walk up to the driver's side. And the guy, I remember he had big, bushy, curly hair. He had a black leather jacket on. And kind of talking about being in a jail, you're learning how to, like, talk to people. And I'm getting indicators, and I'm recognizing that, like, something about this car isn't right. But I'm young and excited and inexperienced, so I'm not paying attention. I smell alcohol in his breath, and I'm like, I'm not surprised if it wasn't probably my first DUI. Then I grab the guy and I pull him out of the car, and he is very standoffish. He's looking around. He's paying attention to his surroundings. He's just looking around, and I can tell, like, he's making a decision, right?
Right.
And I end up – the people in the car are shifting around. They're moving around. I haven't learned – I didn't call for backup because we didn't have backup. You know, I didn't – and I hadn't learned – that when you recognize something's out of whack, something could be a little dangerous, you need another car, another light, another set of eyes. I'm right. Just going to handle this on my own. And there's a guy, a heavy set guy sitting in the front seat and two girls in the back seat. And they're nervous. They're real nervous. The people in the car start wanting to get out. And they're like, can we leave? I want to call a ride. Can we leave? We're not under arrest. Can we leave? And I let them. A car finally shows up and I'm just thinking, let's get them out of here. You know, they jump in a car and they roll off. And I put this guy in the back seat of my car. He's in handcuffs. Now I've arrested him for DUI. I remember he's wearing jeans and cowboy boots and a black leather jacket. And I'm doing an inventory of the car. And there's a mound underneath the passenger side floorboard. And you being in DEA, probably remember the crank days. I'd never seen crank. I knew about this stuff, but I hadn't actually seen finished crank. And I rolled up. There's a Tupperware container in there. And there's a bag on the bottom. It's kind of got this wet, brownish white. Powder in there, and it's still got that little bit of hint of chemical, but there's like 5 ounces of marijuana on top of it. I'm like, woof. I'm like, I got them. I found a bunch of marijuana. I think I'm doing a big deal. You know what I mean? And I find this is where I learned about meth labs. I find a bag rolled up, and there's, I don't know, 25 to 50 white mini thin bottles with ephedrine in them, and there's lithium batteries and all this in there. And then I look up to the driver's door, and along the A pillar is a fully loaded AK-47 sitting right by the driver's side. Whoa. Yeah. Now, the guy driving the car, which I didn't know at the time, and I realized later, his daughter grew up with my little sister, and I used to babysit him. And I was always nice to her, and I was always nice to these people, but I didn't know him. But he had a partner in crime. And that guy rode to work with my dad every day back and forth to work. And my dad was always nice to them. Nope. They were always nice to him. I was always nice to them. We always treated people with respect. Like I said, it was a good idea. And I don't know what they planned, but he'd already been in jail and he'd already been in prison. I think he was out on an existing charge at the time. And that pound or pound and a half of methamphetamine and the gun and everything probably – I'm not sure when he turned down that gravel road, they didn't have a little more sinister plan. But yeah. I think when he wrecked, because remember I said I was getting him out and I'm trying to do sobriety tests and I could see him looking around and shifting around and I could just see him thinking, right? And I think whether they planned to or not, we'll never know, but I'm not sure he didn't be like, I'm just going to let this go. You know what I mean? I'm not going to hurt this kid. I'm going to let this go. I got lucky. You know what I mean? And I'm okay with that. That's okay because I'm learning. I paid attention. But once I got that, I called that sergeant that I left the ticket book in the car. He was the narcotics detective. And I called him. Okay, I got all this weed. And he's like, who do you got? And I said the guy's name. And he's like, what? He's like, you have one of the largest meth cooks in three counties. And he's like, is there anything else in the car? And I'm like, yeah, he's got an AK-47. He's like, I'll be right there. And Division of Narcotics comes down, and I don't go home and go to bed that night. They start writing search warrants, and we kick in a bunch of doors, and all of a sudden I'm like, this is what I want to do. this is fun stuff. I got the bug. You know what I mean?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So
wow,
I got pretty good at it. I went through a lot of crazy things in Montgomery County, Iowa, and I worked with some great people. You know, I mean, just we had to work really hard. We didn't have enough personnel. We didn't have a lot of resources. We did a lot of trash pulls. We did a lot of warrants and things like that. And it was exciting and fun, but it wasn't. And I wanted more. And so that's when I decided I wanted to go work in a bigger metropolitan area because I wanted to have more depth. I knew I wanted to work undercover at some point, and I knew I could never do it in that community.
Yeah. Most of our listeners know what a trash pool is, but just tell everybody what it is, please.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they still do it a little bit, but back in them days, I don't want to quote it exactly by law. I'm no lawyer or nothing, but basically once you set your trash out to the curb, you no longer have reasonable expectation of privacy. And right. So we would get in our beat up old pickups and drive around the middle of the night and roll up these trash cans to suspected drug dealers, or back in them time, it was mostly hunting meth cooks. And we'd grab their bags of trash and throw them in the back of our truck. Sometimes we even jump on the back of a trash truck, ride it up and grab the trash and take it with us. And you go back and disgustingly put on your gloves and get a table out and you search through the trash and you find pseudoephedrine pills and battery casings and you write a search warrant. And next thing you know, you're banging down a door and you get in a meth lab. So yeah, we'd pull the trash to establish probable cause for a warrant, a search warrant, and then search the homes that way.
Even feds do trash runs, believe it or not.
Hell yeah. You can get a lot of stuff on the trash.
You're not kidding. I can remember being down in Miami in the late 80s, and some of those trash runs, you'd actually get kilo wrappers out of them. They get the kilo, they break it down, get the powder out, pulverize it, and then just throw it in the trash.
Remember when they would ship it with cellophane and red axle grease? We would find the red axle grease wrappings in the trash, and we got to where we could testify expertly that that is for transporting narcotics. Even if we couldn't get a testable amount, they'd usually give you a warrant on it.
Yep. Yeah. So now you've been bitten by the bug and you're ready to go. How big is the police department?
I mean, I don't know how many they have now. At the time I was there, I think we were like just over 100 officers, 100, 110. Still not a big place. But Montgomery County Sheriff's Office at the time when I worked there was 10 officers total. You know what I mean? Probably counting the sheriff. When you were on shift, you were by yourself. So now we had more than one precinct. You know, we had a lot of different divisions. And, you know, of course, I went straight to midnight patrols. I had to go back through another academy. And I had to go through an actual FTO program, which I was very thankful for. That's a professional way to do business, you know. I talked to one of my old chiefs not too long ago, and I said, remember when you had the FTO program? We had a 43% attrition rate. We would cut 43% of the officers from FTO. And he said, if you guys want to keep them, you keep them. But if you don't want to work with them and you don't feel they're safe, cut them. And we were cutting people because back then, you know, when people apply for police jobs, you get 200-300 applicants for 5 spots.
Right. So you got the cream of the crop that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Isn't that a suburb of Omaha?
Yeah. It's a border town, Omaha. So Harrison, north side of Harrison Street's Omaha. South, I think the Omaha Metro is right a million. It's a pretty good sized metropolitan area. So it's only 100, 110 officers. It's a pretty big city. You know what I mean? Like we had all the same crimes that any major metro has to deal with.
Yeah. How long did you have to do patrol until you could to go to what is now your love, narcotics?
Yep. Not very long. I didn't have to do it very long at all. I think luckily I had gone through and I had experienced working alone and had to figure out how to do more in-depth law enforcement by myself. When you get in a bigger department, you have a detective bureau and you have this and you have this and you have this. When you work by yourself, I mean, I'm pulling trash on patrol. That's not common, you know. When I went, you better not be pulling trash on patrol. You got calls and you got stick to a district. You know, you work whatever district. You don't work the whole city. You work whatever district that you're assigned. So I remember my district was 741, they called it. But some districts were better than others and some were much more busy than others. I think I was hired in there in 2003. And in 2005, I went to the narcotics. It was called Special Investigations Unit. But while I was working on the road patrol, I was building the resume. I knew I wanted to get into narcotics because I knew that'd be my opportunity to work dope and do what I thought was the fun stuff. So I have started going to continuing education training. You know, I would sign up for every bit of what, I mean, how to write search warrants and how to do all this stuff. So when a slot came open, which it didn't very often, I had a nice resume. And while I was working on patrol, if I'd pull a guy over, I was definitely doing a lot of interdiction stuff. I was pretty good about searching cars and finding guns and drugs. And instead of just booking them, I learned early on to be very intuitive and ask a lot of questions. And I started to learn how to develop sources. And so in patrol, I was already developing sources for the narcotics, the special investigations unit. So when a slot came open, I got hired in there. Next thing you know, I'm growing my hair out and growing a beard and driving a Trans Am.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, real cool.
I had a Trans Am there for a while. I love that car.
I didn't like getting in and out of it, but it was fun driving it.
Well, when you're younger, it's easier. But
yeah, a lot easier.
Now I'm good with a pickup truck.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, that kind of, the perks of the job.
Yeah. You got to earn them.
Yeah, exactly. How many guys were in your narcotics unit?
Oh, I think we had our specific special investigations unit had, I think, 8 guys. But then we were also part of what was called a metro-wide drug task force. And so we had, I think they were called 28E agreements to work cross-jurisdictionally. So say like Omaha, everything we did was in Omaha. If it wasn't our city, it was in Omaha. And we worked pretty closely with – Omaha had several different shifts of narcotics units. And so I think they had at the time like 700 officers, maybe more than that even. And so we would kind of link up, you know, just like we were talking about earlier on, it's important to learn how to network. And you go to training together and you start to work a few cases together, and guys and girls build good relationships with each other. And so quickly I learned how to do that too. And I would, you know, hey, I got this case, you know, I've got a source, a snitch or whatever is telling me about this restaurant that's selling a bunch of dope, or they're buying ammunition. There was one restaurant that was buying a bunch of ammunition. They were shipping it back down to Mexico and stuff. So we would cross work together quite a bit in that area. And it worked well. You know what I mean?
So it's not just, well, guns and drugs go together, but it wasn't just narcotics. So whatever crime came along, you guys participated in, because it's part of it.
Yeah. You know, we were a special investigations unit. So our primary role was we took care of all the narcotics complaints. We were expected to clear cases. We were expected to turn informants. We were expected to write search warrants. I think most of us are writing 10 to 15 warrants a month each back then, you know, so we were busy.
Wow.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, we loved kicking doors out. That seemed like the good way to do police work at the time, right? High volume of traffic, lots of people coming and going. Let's pull the trash, write a warrant, get in the door and see what we find. And then when you find what you're looking for, if you're really smart, you'll sit down and have a conversation with the person, right?
Absolutely.
And extract as much information as you can from them before they're ever under arrest, or at least that you've told them they are. And hopefully develop a cooperating witness or a cooperating informant, or straight up snitch, just don't want to get into trouble, and take it further.
That's narcotics 101 right there, ladies and gentlemen. You just got a quick education class on how to develop sources.
Yeah.
We've been going here close to an hour now. So what I'd like to do is we'll call it quit to today, but Dutch has agreed to continue because we're going to get into some really good stories next. So you definitely want to come back tomorrow. And that's pretty much just going to be all about some of these stories, because he's involved what he's telling us about now is local narcotics within Omaha area. But he doesn't know that I know. He did a whole lot more than that. So we'll get into that tomorrow. So, Dutch, thank you very much, brother. We'll see you tomorrow. Everybody out there, thank you. Be sure to come back tomorrow. Appreciate your support. Until then, God bless. See you tomorrow.
Thanks, Steve.